All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's March 25th. And this microphone is really nice because I can talk louder than you guys, no matter what. All right, so we're going to finish up endocrinology today, maybe move on to muscle. But let's see, this is the last lecture before spring break, okay? And so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. It's going to go around, okay? And if you sign, you're here and you don't sign, to me that's like not being here, right? And if you sign in the wrong place, that's like not being here. And if you sign the wrong signature, that's like not being here, right? So sign, I know you're wondering how this all happens. I'm not sure how it happens, okay? But just sign your name in the spot where the correct date is, okay? And also, for the next test, on the previous test, if you had a smudge on your Scantron, or if you didn't completely erase an answer, right, but it confused the Scantron reader, I gave you credit for it. But from now on, I'm not going to give you credit for it, right? So make sure that when you come to take a test, you bring an eraser that actually works, right, and a clean Scantron. All right, so I just want to mention that to people. All right, so you're probably wondering, gee, he mentioned test. When is the next test? And what's going to be on the next test? All right, so I've been looking at the schedule right here. The chapters that are going to be on the next test are chapters 9, 10, and 11. So that's autonomic nervous system, sensory, and endocrinology. And we're scheduled according to the tentative schedule on April 15th. But that's way too far away. Okay, that's like 2 weeks after spring break. So we're going to have it, I think, maybe on the 13th, which is Monday. That will give you a whole week after spring break. But, huh? That's a Tuesday. Yeah, it's a Tuesday. And, all right, but don't blow spring break. All right, you got to probably press ahead and start to study some of the other chapters that are going to be on test number 4, because that's coming up pretty fast.
So you think we're for sure?
Oh, the test 3? Yeah. All right, let's set the date for the 13th of April, which is Tuesday. All right. So that takes a lot of pressure off of you during spring break, but you know what? That's okay, because when pressure is taken off, the anxiety goes away, I expect you to do even more, right? Because you're not inhibited by that anxiety. So make sure you apply yourselves during spring break. That's all I can say. And unfortunately, I might not be able to respond to emails. Oh well, that's the way it goes. Okay. Okay, so that's April 13th, exam number 3. All right, so does anybody have any questions over the stuff we talked about last time? We're good? Okay. Well, today we are going to talk about a number of endocrine glands. So let's see, what's an endocrine gland again? What's a real simple definition of an endocrine gland? It is a ductless gland, right? Ductless gland, so it secretes its product where? Not into a duct, but directly into the blood, and then it's carried everywhere in the body. And what is the product that it secretes? A hormone. So you got to know what a hormone is, right? So we say that it's secreted by an endocrine gland, but you got to know what an endocrine gland is. Travels through the blood to get to a target tissue. And you have to know what a target tissue is. What is a target tissue? What's special about a target tissue as opposed to some other kind of tissue? It's got to have a receptor to that particular chemical. And what's the relationship between a receptor and that signaling molecule that we call a hormone? I'm not quite sure I heard.
Complementary.
The shapes are complementary, right. The signaling molecule, sometimes we call that a ligand, has to bind to a receptor to elicit that response, and it binds to a active site. The active site has to match up in shape and electrical charge and things like that, and polarity, in order for that ligand to bind to that receptor, right? And we can use like the lock and key model or hand and glove model to help explain the affinity and specificity of a ligand to its particular receptor, right? And when a signaling molecule binds to a receptor, what happens? Is that it? Is that the end of the story? What happens after that? The signaling molecule is going to do what? It's going to change the behavior of the target tissue somehow. It's going to change the metabolism, or maybe it's going to insert a channel into the plasma membrane, but it's going to change the behavior of that target tissue. All right, and then you should know two main classes of hormones. What are the two main classes of hormones? And that's going to determine what kind of receptors they have. Water-soluble versus lipid-soluble. All right, so hydrophilic versus hydrophobic kinds of compounds. Can you give me an example of a hydrophobic hormone? Of a lipid-type hormone? Yeah, all the steroids are, for instance, as well as thyroxine, right, as well as thyroxine. And the other peptide hormones are hydrophilic. Okay, so then you should think of where the receptors are for these different classes of hormones. Where are the lipophilic receptors located, or the hydrophobic receptors are located? In the cytoplasm, or maybe even inside the nucleus. Right, because those kinds of hormones, like steroid hormones, can actually enter the cell. They're not excluded from the cell because they can move freely through the cell membrane, as opposed to hydrophilic hormones can't get inside the cell. So where do they have to bind to a receptor if they can't get inside? On the outside of the cell, on the cell membrane. All right, so then, how does that signal get inside the cell? If it binds to a receptor on the cell membrane, how does a signal get inside the cell? What can you tell me about a hydrophilic hormone? It's a messenger. What kind of messenger is it? It's a first messenger. And when it binds to receptor, it stimulates the production of a second messenger inside the cell. What do we call that process of taking a signal outside the cell, converting it into a second messenger inside the cell? That is called signal transduction. That's right, signal transduction. Okay, and we saw a number of schemes that do that. Mostly they work through what kind of receptor mechanism? G-protein coupled receptors, right? Okay, and for the lipophilic type hormones that bind to cytosolic or nuclear receptors, how do they change metabolism inside the cell? What do they act as? Yeah, they stimulate RNA synthesis, which means what? Transcription. So they act as transcription factors because they initiate transcription. All right, so those are some of the things we talked about last time. And so let's start talking about some other particular hormones, in particular the pituitary gland. All right, so the pituitary gland is at the base of the brain, and it's associated with the sphenoid bone. There is a fossa in the sphenoid bone that holds the pituitary gland, and you should remember what that's called. What is that fossa called? It's got a special name that's in the sphenoid bone. Where's the sphenoid bone? It goes all the way across, right, from right to left, and it's right smack in the middle, and somebody said the cella turcica, and that's right. Right, so there is a depression right there that houses the pituitary gland. So here we see the pituitary gland. It's closely associated to the part of the brain we call the hypothalamus, and then here is the optic chiasma right here to give you an idea of where it is. And the pituitary gland is physically connected to the hypothalamus here via this structure that we call the infundibulum. All right, and it's connected functionally in two different ways. It's connected by blood vessels, but it's also connected by a tract. So there's two different ways. There's a nerve tract, which carries action potentials, as well as a portal blood vessel that goes from capillaries in the hypothalamus to capillaries in the anterior part of the pituitary gland. So what you see on this slide right here, besides the infundibulum, is that the pituitary is broken down into two main regions. At least for this class, we're going to break it down into an anterior part and a posterior part. And the posterior part is made up of nervous tissue, and the anterior part is made up of glandular tissue. So that's the big distinction. The anterior is glandular, the posterior part is basically axon terminals. All right, and this infundibulum, anybody take an anatomy class with me? All right, For fun, what did I call this little thing right here? Sometimes it's called a stalk. You'll find that in books. Infundibulum, you'll find in books. But in terms of neuroanatomy, what do we call major bridges that connect major parts of the brain? Like between the pons and the cerebellum. There's some tissue that connects the pons with the cerebellum. And there's some tissue that connects the brain stem with the cerebrum. But remember what those things were called? Major bridges connecting parts of the brain. It's a peduncle, right? Those are called peduncles. So that's coming back to you, unfortunately. No, it's a good thing, right? Peduncle. Well, this reminds me of a really tiny peduncle, right? So what would you call a tiny peduncle? I'm surprised some people forgot peduncle. It's what? A peduncolito. All right, so don't forget peduncle. It's really important. And especially this one right here. Peduncles have tracks, right, that are carrying action potentials or information from one part of the brain to the other. Okay, so this anterior part is glandular tissue. As a matter of fact, it's an endocrine gland. So where is it going to secrete its product? Into a duct someplace? No, right directly into the blood. So there are capillaries right here that pick up the hormones from the anterior pituitary. All right, but this neuronal part, the posterior pituitary, just releases neurotransmitters that are synthesized in the hypothalamus and then are carried down to the posterior pituitary, and they're released when an action potential reaches the axon terminus. So these hormones from the posterior pituitary probably are more appropriately called what? If over here in the anterior pituitary, if they're synthesized and released by glandular tissue, while these in the posterior pituitary are made by neurons and released like a neurotransmitter is when an action potential reaches the axon terminus, what would we call these kinds of hormones over here? Okay, yeah, we would call this a neurohormone, right? So these hormones from the posterior lobe of the pituitary are better called neurohormones because they're released directly from a neuron. All right, so that tells you that in some advanced classes, we don't really separate the nervous system like we did here from the endocrine system. You actually learn about the neuroendocrine system because there are times when you can't really separate the two. They're integrated together in various parts of the body, and this is, I think, maybe the first example. No, we talked about the adrenal medulla as well, right? So there are numerous locations in the body where you can't really separate a control system in terms of it being either a nervous system or endocrine system. They're connected together. Okay. All right, so what about some parts of the pituitary? Let's talk about the posterior pituitary first. All right, so here, what part of the brain is this right here where I'm circling? Yeah, that's the hypothalamus, and there are various nuclei in the hypothalamus that are controlling functions. What the heck is a nucleus? It's that center part of an atom, right? But that's not what I'm talking about here. It's the center of the cell that contains DNA, right? Oh, but that's not what we're talking about here. What are we talking about here? It's a bunch of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system that are non-myelinated, so it's a gray area, right? Because if it's a myelinated part of the nervous system, it looks white. But if it's not myelinated, like this nucleus right here, it looks gray. And these have specific functions. All right, so here we have the paraventricular nucleus on either side of this chamber. Oh, what's this chamber right here? What's this chamber called? Ah, you forgot some anatomy. That's what? The third ventricle? That's the third ventricle. And these nuclei are located on either side of the third ventricle. Here is the supraoptic nucleus. And you can see nerve cell bodies in there. And the name defines its location. It's located, what, superior to the optic chiasma right here. So that's where you would find these. All right, so these nerve cell bodies are synthesizing hormones or neurotransmitters, if you wish, or a better way of calling these would be what, neurohormones. And then these neurohormones are conducted down this axon into the posterior pituitary gland. The two hormones that are being produced are vasopressin. Another name for vasopressin is antidiuretic hormone. The second one is called oxytocin. All right, so how do these hormones move down this axon right here? We call that antegrade flow or retrograde axonal transport. Anterograde, right? It just flows from the cell body down to the axon terminal right here. And of course, since these are axons, what kind of electrical activity do you have in these axons right here? Graded potentials or action potentials or what? Action potentials, that's right. So the hormones move down by axoplasmic flow, and the signal for their release moves down through these axons right here because of action potentials. And when the action potentials reach the axon terminus, it releases vesicles that contain these hormones, and then the hormones are in the extracellular fluid and they're picked up by this blood vessel. What kind of blood vessel can pick up material from the extracellular fluid? And only kind is only a capillary because it's thin enough, right? All right, so now we have these neurotransmitters in the blood, so they're really acting as a neurohormone. So what do we call a bunch of myelinated fibers that are moving someplace together through the central nervous system? It's white matter, sure, because they're going to be myelinated, but there's even a better term. There's even a better term for a group of myelinated fibers, and again, it's white matter, moving through the central nervous system from one part of the brain to the other, or say from the hypothalamus to the posterior pituitary. Yeah, we don't want to call that a nerve, we want to call that a tract. Right, so here is the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, because another name for the pituitary gland is the hypophysis. Right, and so this name then clearly shows you that this tract goes from the hypothalamus into the pituitary gland. Yes. Antidiuretic hormone is the same thing as vasopressin. Okay, and the way they came up with that name, think of this. Vaso has to do with vessels, or in particular, blood vessels. And we haven't talked about the cardiovascular system, but that's coming up. But so think of a balloon, okay? And press on a balloon. What's going to happen to the pressure inside that balloon? Is it going to go up or go down when you start to squeeze it? Okay, it's going to go up, right? So that's where they came up with this name, because vasopressin will have a tendency to cause smooth muscle to constrict down on blood vessels, and when that happens, take a wild guess. What happens to your blood pressure if smooth muscle in your body starts to constrict around your blood vessels? It's going to go up, right? So just think of that water balloon. That's kind of a crude analogy, but not too bad. Okay, antidiuretic hormone works on kidneys to help you retain water, which again will help maintain blood pressure. Okay. Oxytocin, we're going to define some of these, but oxytocin is released. It's a stimulant for smooth muscle, so it causes smooth muscle to contract, especially smooth muscle of the glandular tissue of the breast, and it's responsible for the milk letdown reflex when an infant starts to nurse. And of course, it's also important in parturition, and it causes the uterus to contract. Okay, so those are some of the functions of oxytocin. All right, so posterior pituitary. How many hormones are released from the posterior pituitary? There are two, ADH, you could say, and oxytocin. And the posterior pituitary is basically what kind of tissue? Glandular tissue or nervous tissue? Nervous tissue. So ADH and oxytocin actually are released from neurons in the posterior pituitary. And where do you find the cell bodies of those neurons? Where do you find the cell bodies of those neurons that are in the posterior pituitary? Yeah, the hypothalamus. There are nuclei in the hypothalamus, right? Okay. Well, we said that the anterior pituitary, on the other hand, is glandular tissue, and so I see some glandular tissue right here. Where do glands come from? What kind of tissue do glands come from? What are the four kinds of tissues again? Epithelial tissue. That's a really good start. Okay. Muscle tissue is one, nervous tissue is another, and connective tissue. So of those four basic tissues, where do glands come from in most cases? Epithelium, right? So this anterior pituitary, is it really some epithelium during development, right, that migrates very close to this neural part of the pituitary gland, and they fuse together. All right, so we do not have nerve axons going into the anterior pituitary. All right, so nonetheless, this tissue is glandular tissue, and it's going to secrete a number of hormones, And those hormones are picked up directly by the blood because surrounding this glandular tissue is a network of capillaries, and then these hormones are transported all over the body. The anterior pituitary hormones are transported throughout the whole body. Okay. And these hormones from the anterior pituitary are, the release of the anterior pituitary hormones are controlled by the hypothalamus, right? Just like the release of oxytocin and ADH from the posterior pituitary, because there are other neurons that send projections down into this part of the hypothalamus we call the median eminence. They release neurohormones that are picked up by this capillary bed in the median eminence, and then they're transported to the anterior pituitary. The hormones from the hypothalamus cause the release of additional hormones from the anterior pituitary. All right, so when we look at this system right here, we see, well, I tell you what, let's just think of a normal circulatory system. What is a normal circulation? You got two. You got like a pulmonary circulation and a systemic circulation. Right, what do you call a blood vessel taking blood away from a heart? That's an artery. That feeds a? Where does exchange take place? A capillary, and a capillary empties blood into the vessel that takes blood back to the heart, which is what we call a vein. So in a normal circulation, how many capillary beds are there between an artery and a vein? There's just one. All right, so here we see a special one. There are two capillary beds. So here is the arterial supply, probably nicely color-coded in red. Here is the venous, right, return to the heart, probably nicely color-coded in blue. All right. And we see two capillary beds back-to-back connected by something that is not a capillary. What do we call this kind of blood vessel that connects two capillary beds back-to-back before it goes back to the heart? That's a portal system, right? And in anatomy, you learned about the hepatic portal system. All right, so this is very atypical. There are three main areas in your body that have portal circulations. One is the hepatic portal system. This one right here between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland. And when we get to the kidney, we're going to see another one. Okay. So remember, a portal blood vessel connects two capillaries without going back to the heart. And so what's the beauty of a portal system? It's a special delivery system. It can pick something up in one area of the body and deliver it specifically to another location without diluting all of that material in the rest of the circulation. Right? So the amount of hormones that are released by the hypothalamus are really minuscule because they're not diluted with the whole circulation. They're delivered directly to the anterior pituitary. Right? And that also gives very nice, efficient and sensitive control over the anterior pituitary from these neurohormones from the hypothalamus. All right, so what are the hormones that are released by the anterior pituitary? We're going to talk about hypothalamic control in just a little bit, but let's define what some of these hormones are that are released by the anterior pituitary. We got six trophic hormones, and sometimes we can call those trophic hormones. That just means that they will stimulate other target tissues in the body. So here we see breast. And the hormone from the anterior pituitary that is going to have an effect on the breast is prolactin. So what does the breast tissue have to have? All right, and the adrenal cortex does not have. What does it have? It has to have a receptor for prolactin. All right, so it's got to have a receptor. All right, so prolactin is important because during gestation, it's going to cause development of the glandular tissue of the breast so that after parturition, the breast can actually produce a milk product. All right, so the breast has to develop. It has to proliferate. And then during pregnancy, prolactin has to be there to maintain the glandular tissue of the breast. All right, so that's really important, which is different than the milk letdown reflex or ejection of milk from the breast. What do you need to have ejection of milk from the breast? Okay, you need oxytocin, which we just previously talked about, because oxytocin causes contraction of smooth muscle, which then ejects milk from the breast. So two important hormones. Prolactin first is necessary for development of the glandular tissue and maintenance of it during gestation. but oxytocin is necessary for the ejection during nursing. That's we're going to look at that maybe as a nice neuroendocrine reflex. All right, so that's prolactin. Another hormone, growth hormone, causes protein synthesis, bone growth, muscle growth, all right, as well as growth in adipose tissue. And so you can abbreviate that, GH, if you wish. Okay. And, for instance, if there are levels, if the levels of prolactin are very low during pregnancy and gestation, then, of course, the function of the breast will be abnormal, will be reduced. Right? And the same thing, if growth hormone is diminished, there won't be proper growth taking place in these tissues. Okay, some other hormones. Thyroid stimulating hormone works on the thyroid gland. Go ahead, show me where the thyroid gland is. Don't press it too hard. I don't want to like, squish out a bunch of thyroid juice into your body. But there's your thyroid gland, right? Okay. On either side of the laryngeal prominence is the thyroid gland. And thyroid stimulating hormone promotes the growth of the thyroid gland and the production of thyroid hormone, and it controls the release of thyroid hormone from the thyroid gland. So hence we call that a trophic hormone, right? It stimulates the thyroid gland. Another one is adrenal corticotropic hormone. Where's the adrenal cortex? Am I pointing to it? What am I pointing to? The adrenal medulla. Ooh, what does the adrenal medulla secrete? Epinephrine, right? Epinephrine. Well, adrenal corticotropic hormone has really nothing to do with the adrenal medulla because that's controlled by the sympathetic nervous system. ACTH controls the development of the cortex of the adrenal gland and the release of hormones from the adrenal cortex like glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoids. A mineralocorticoid is something that helps regulate minerals in our body like aldosterone. Glucocorticoids help regulate glucose metabolism in our body, like cortisol and cortisone. All right, so the adrenal cortex releases glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoids when it's stimulated by ACTH right here, adrenal corticotropic hormone. And then lastly, there are two hormones that we call gonadotropins. What's a gonad? And what does a gonad produce? Okay, a gonad. Give me an example of a gonad.
Ovaries.
What's another example of a gonad? Testes. Okay. And, of course, you should know which sex has which, right? And what does a gonad do? It produces what? It produces sex hormones, number one, but it produces also some structures, which are very important for reproduction. It produces something called... And I don't have it on my slide right here to see if the microphone is going to act up. Something called what? A gamete. Okay? And a gamete is a sex cell. And I forget, a lot of people have never had a biology class in here. A sex cell. All right, so is that alive? Yeah, because why? Ooh, I almost fell off the stage. I hate it when that happens. Okay, because they're made out of cells, right? So they have cytoplasm, they have DNA. All right, and so how about, what's the name of a male sex cell? Sperm. Okay, and female would be? Oocyte, or egg, or something like that. And these are kind of strange cells in the body because why? In terms of their genetics, in terms of their DNA. Okay, they have... one half the normal number of chromosomes. All right. So, does anybody know the name? How many chromosomes does a normal cell in your body have? 46. Okay. But it's in a very special arrangement. How would you break that 46 up? Into two pairs of chromosomes, right? So you get one pair over here and another pair over here. 1 through 23, and then another 1 through 23 over here. Right? And the reason why you have two pairs is because you have two parents, right? I mean, you might not have two parents right now, but at some time in your life you had two parents. Even if you were born in a test tube, you still had two parents at some point in time, right? So these are, we call maternal chromosomes, and these are the papa chromosomes, right? Or paternal. All right, but a sperm or an oocyte only has like one set. All right, so when a sperm and an oocyte, so we got 23 chromosomes right here. We call that haploid, 23 over here. When a sperm and an oocyte join together, they'd make this thing again with what? 46 chromosomes inside the nucleus. So now, what do you call this process right here? This is, you all know, maybe you're thinking of spring, you're thinking of spring break, be careful. Fertilization. That's fertilization, right? You all knew that. And what is this single cell called? You are all one of these. That's a zygote. Okay. Now, here's another process. How do you go from a cell with 46? Oops, I'm writing on myself. I think I ran out of batteries or something. You know, and I can't tell if that light's on. It's on? All right, I'll figure that out in a second. Okay, so how do you go from a cell with 46? This is what we call diploid. How do you go from a cell with 46 chromosomes to one with 23? Somebody said this one already. This is meiosis, right? That is meiosis right there. Okay, so that's the job of these gonads right here. All right, let me see if I can get the recorder back working again. Maybe it unplugged. Oh, wow, I can't even turn it off. Maybe the batteries are going. Or I broke it. Or it got embarrassed because of the conversation we were having. I'm not sure. Okay. Technology can do some weird things. All right, so gonadotropins right here, there are two gonadotropins that both males and females have. All right, and one is called follicle-stimulating hormone, and the other is called luteinizing hormone. Both males and females have them. Follicle-stimulating hormone, I think it was named first because of female physiology. Okay, the thing that comes before an oocyte is called a follicle. And when a follicle matures, it spits out an oocyte. All right, so FSH causes the maturation of a follicle so that it can produce an oocyte. All right, so if in the female FSH produces oocytes, guess what FSH does in the male? It stimulates spermatogenesis. It supports spermatogenesis. So that's what FSH does. Okay, what's the other gonadotropin? Don't forget there are two. One is FSH. What's the second one? LH. All right, so LH in the male is responsible or stimulates production of testosterone. That's what it does in the male. But in the female, it does something different. All right, it causes this process to happen. All right, and we call that ovulation. All right, so LH is important for ovulation in the female and testosterone production in the male. And I think I have this all outlined in the next slide right here. Yeah, I sure do. All right, so LH causes ovulation secretion, or ovulation, of course, in the female, and secretion of testosterone in the male. So here's a pretty nice synopsis of what these trophic hormones do. Okay. So you might be interested in knowing how the release exactly of these hormones is controlled. We said what? That it is controlled by trophic hormones from the hypothalamus that move through the portal circulation into the anterior pituitary. All right, so I think that's going to take me to my next slide right here. So release of anterior pituitary hormones is controlled by hypothalamic releasing and maybe some inhibiting factors, all right, from the hypothalamus. All right, and they're released by these neurons right here. And they get transmitted by this portal system into the anterior pituitary. So let's figure out what some of these are. All right, so FSH, what's a general term for FSH and LH together. What are these both called?
Gonadotropins,
right? So these are gonadotropins. Gonadotropins, right here. This one and this one. And what gland releases them? These are hormones, so a gland has to release them. What gland releases these? Pituitary. You're close. Which kind of pituitary? Anterior pituitary. All right, but the anterior pituitary can't make up its own mind when to release those hormones. It has to be signaled by another hormone. And where does that hormone come from? The hypothalamus. So here we have hypothalamus. Right here. And if these are gonadotropins that are going to be released by the anterior pituitary, what is that signal that is coming from the hypothalamus into the anterior pituitary? Sometimes we abbreviate gonadotropins as capital G, little n, gonadotropin. But remember, you got to think of what? Both LH and FSH, both of them together. All right, so here is a chemical signal coming down. What kind of system is this right here? Is this a tract or blood vessel? Aha, it's a portal blood vessel because it's going where? To the anterior pituitary. See it right here on the slide? Here it is right here on the slide. Okay. So it's the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. So what do we call this hormone? We're going to call this gonadotropin. What's the abbreviation for gonadotropin? GN, okay, RH for releasing hormone. So when GnRH increases, what happens to FSH and LH release from the anterior pituitary? It increases as well, right? And as GnRH decreases, so does the release of FSH and LH from the anterior pituitary. All right, sometimes it's called releasing factor, but most people now are just calling it releasing hormones instead of releasing factors, right? But you'll see both terms. All right, what about thyroid stimulating hormone? Where does that come from? Where does that come from? Pituitary, you'd be really close if you were to say that. Which one? Anterior pituitary, so the anterior pituitary releases thyroid stimulating hormone, which goes, of course, where? Yeah, to that little butterfly right there. All right, but how does the anterior pituitary know to release thyroid stimulating hormone? What controls the anterior pituitary? The hypothalamus, right? So here is that portal system bringing down a hormone to the anterior pituitary that causes the release of thyroid stimulating hormone. What would we name that particular hormone? Thyroid stimulating hormone, releasing hormone. All right, so the hypothalamus releases what? Releasing hormones, TSH, RH. All right, so that would be a pretty good one. What about the adrenal glands? In particular, the cortex. What does the anterior pituitary release to stimulate the adrenal cortex? ACTH, adrenal corticotropic hormone. All right, and how does the anterior pituitary know to release ACTH? Because there is a releasing hormone from the hypothalamus, right? And what would we call that? ACTH-RH. That's kind of the old name for it. All right, but I think you're kind of getting the scheme of how things work. Now it's just called corticotropin-releasing hormone, CRH. All right, but if you want to use that long form, that's fine with me. All right, so what's the point that I'm trying to drive in here? That the hypothalamus releases what? Releasing hormones which stimulate the anterior pituitary to release their trophic hormones on various other target tissues, like the thyroid gland or the adrenal cortex or the gonads, right? Or muscle and bone if it's growth hormone. All right, so what would you call the trophic hormone from the hypothalamus that causes the release of growth hormone? That would be? Yeah, GHRH over here. Okay? All right, so I think you can fill in the rest of the pieces. what we don't really have time to talk about in here, and actually maybe even in a physiology class. Even in a physiology class, we don't have time to talk. You'd have to take an endocrinology class. Okay? You'd have to I'm ready for spring break too. You'd have to take an endocrinology class that really spends a whole semester to look at this, because not only are there releasing hormones, but sometimes the hypothalamus releases inhibitory hormones on the anterior pituitary. All right, so I can't give you a super clear picture, but the clearest picture I want you to have is that the anterior pituitary is different than the posterior pituitary. Anterior pituitary responds to hormones released from the hypothalamus via the portal system, and those hormones are called releasing hormones. Okay, and they're usually directly related to each other. Okay. All right, so we have, how does your body maintain homeostasis? Through the use of what kind of stuff? Negative feedback, but think of, starts with an L. Loops, right? Response loops, okay, which employ feedback to receptor someplace or an integration center someplace. All right, so here we have a response loop. What does a response loop always start with? A stimulus ends in a response, and the response can feed back to the initial stimulus, and if the stimulus, if the response subtracts from the stimulus, we call that what kind of feedback? Negative feedback. And if it enhances the response, we call that positive feedback. All right, so here we have, let's look at the system that includes the hypothalamus, the anterior pituitary, and gonads, like testes or ovary, for instance. So the hypothalamus is going to release GnRH, that's gonadotropin-releasing hormone. And where is that going to go? Anterior pituitary, and pretty much only the anterior pituitary, because why? How does it get to that anterior pituitary? Through what kind of special, does it go by a neuron or blood or what? Yeah, it goes by the blood via that portal system, right? Okay. So it gets to the anterior pituitary, and it's going to stimulate the production as well as the release of FSH and LH. These are what we call gonadotropins. And when FSH and LH are released in the anterior pituitary, they're picked up by those capillaries and delivered to either an ovary or a testes. Right? And it's going to promote the growth of the maintenance of the gonads, as well as the oogenesis and spermatogenesis. But it's also going to cause the release of sex steroids, like androgens for male and estrogens and even some progesterones for females. Okay, and when these hormones are released by the gonads, of course, since they're hormones, where do they go? What are they picked up by? By the blood, because there's capillaries in the gonads, and they're carried back to the anterior pituitary. They're carried back to the brain, to the hypothalamus, where under most circumstances, okay, they're going to feed back in a negative fashion to maintain proper function of these gonads right here, proper levels of FSH and LH, which then will maintain the proper levels of estrogens and androgens in the blood. So notice that these hormones, these estrogens and androgens, can feed back to two different areas of your brain and pituitary. So this one sometimes we call a short feedback loop, and the one that goes all the way back to the hypothalamus, we call that a long feedback loop. So there are a number of different feedback loops. All right. In each case, if estrogen and androgens increase in level, what's going to happen to the secretion of GnRH? All right, as estrogens and androgens increase, what happens to GnRH? Since it's negative feedback, right, it's going to cause a decrease of GnRH, right? And same thing for if there's negative feedback on the anterior pituitary, increasing levels of estrogens and androgens will decrease the level of FSH and LH. So this is what happens under most circumstances. All right, but now we did talk about positive feedback. What does positive feedback usually produce? A disease-free state or a disease process? Disease process. It drives you further away from what? From the set point, right? The proper normal level, for instance, of estrogens and androgens in your body. But in females, under certain circumstances, right, LH from the anterior pituitary actually feeds back and it causes additional release of GnRH, and which is going to cause additional release of LH, right? Which is going to cause an addition, through that positive feedback mechanism, an additional release of LH, which causes more LH to be released, which then causes more LH to be released. So if we're going to plot out LH, blood concentrations, maybe during the menstrual cycle, we'll see it starts out small, and then it increases, and it increases, because here we have some positive feedback taking place. So the question would be, how come the whole universe isn't filled up with LH? Because you have this nice positive feedback mechanism. There's something special that happens. When LH reaches a super high level right here, it causes, what's this process called? When you have a follicle spitting out an oocyte. Ovulation. When LH reaches a certain level, ovulation takes place, and now this follicle disappears. After ovulation, a follicle becomes, we call this the corpus luteum. And when the corpus luteum appears, the positive feedback cycle is broken, right? And then LH drops. So right at this point right here, this is what we call ovulation. So positive feedback only works for a short period of time right here. It can't happen forever because something drastic has to happen, right? And the drastic thing that happens is ovulation, and the follicle gets destroyed, and something that replaces it is called the corpus luteum. Okay, so that's another example of positive feedback that happens under natural, normal circumstances, which is not a disease process in the body. Where else did we see positive feedback as being a normal, natural process? Yeah, we didn't talk about blood clotting yet, but you're right. But in those sodium channels, in the first phase of an action potential, what's that first phase of an action potential called? Yeah, depolarization. There is a positive feedback cycle that starts with depolarization. So you get some initial sodium channels opening, so sodium rushes inside the cell. That depolarizes the cell, which causes more sodium channels to open, which causes more depolarization, which causes more voltage-gated sodium channels to open. That causes, a massive depolarization and the beginning of that action potential. Okay, so where is the hypothalamus located? Yeah, it's in your brain. It's in your central nervous system. So it's surrounded by neurons that are integrating information from all over your body, right? So sensory receptors, thinking processes that you're going through, because the hypothalamus is right there in the brain. So it receives input from what we call higher brain centers, like the cerebral cortex, and these even things that you are thinking can affect the secretion of anterior pituitary via releasing hormones from the hypothalamus. So emotional states, psychological stress can affect circadian rhythms, the menstrual cycle, and even adrenal hormones. So things that you're going through in your normal life will affect your whole endocrine system because it's connected to the hypothalamus. All right, so let's talk specifically about the posterior pituitary. What are some hormones? How many hormones from the posterior pituitary? Yeah, only two. All right, and we see that they are antidiuretic hormone, which we call vasopressin sometimes, and then the second one is oxytocin. Do I have a slide? Oh, here, good. Let's talk about this one. All right, so here's the posterior pituitary, and the two nuclei were the paraventricular nucleus and the supraoptic nucleus. The supraoptic nucleus synthesizes oxytocin, transmits it via axonal transport to the axon terminals in the posterior pituitary. So when an action potential reaches the axon terminus of this neuron right here via this hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, it's not a portal blood vessel, but that's a tract, that causes release of ADH. Okay, and then that ADH is picked up by a capillary, and the posterior pituitary is delivered everywhere in the body. Right, and the paraventricular nuclei right here synthesize oxytocin, which then is transported in an antegrade fashion via exoplasmic flow to the axon terminus, and when action potentials travel down this track, it releases oxytocin. Okay. From the posterior pituitary gland. And you should remember what the effects of ADH and oxytocin are. I didn't really talk much about ADH. Causes vasoconstriction, which boosts blood pressure, but it also works on the kidneys. The kidneys, all day long, are taking fluid from your blood, and that fluid is going to end up in urine. Right? The process of the kidney taking fluid from your body and putting it into urine, one of the processes is what we call filtration. Right, so the body, the kidneys are filtering blood all the time, and you would lose all of that fluid. What ADH does is that it enhances reabsorption from the kidney. So fluid that's going to end up in urine is reabsorbed and put back into the bloodstream. So when you see something about how ADH works, it enhances reabsorption. It is taking fluid from something that's going to become urine, which means what? Do you retain urine or do you eliminate urine? You eliminate it from your body. What ADH does is it takes fluid that will eventually end up in urine and put it back into your cardiovascular system. So we call that reabsorption. So ADH enhances reabsorption of fluids, yet the kidney puts it back in your cardiovascular system. Okay, let's talk about the adrenal gland. So remember where the adrenal glands are. They're just, sometimes we call those suprarenal glands, which means that they're on top of the kidneys, right? So here's an adrenal gland. It's got a superficial part and a deep part. And we're primarily interested in the superficial part right here, right, which is called the cortex. The deep part is the medulla. And you know a lot about the adrenal medulla already. What does it release? Yeah, epinephrine and norepinephrine, and how would you talk about those compounds being released from the adrenal medulla? They're neural hormones, right? And what about the cells that release epinephrine and norepinephrine? What's a way to think about those cells? They're part of the sympathetic nervous system. What kind of cell of the sympathetic nervous system are they mimicking? The postganglionic neuron, right? So they're acting like the postganglionic neuron. When they are stimulated by the preganglionic neuron, then they release epinephrine and norepinephrine directly into the extracellular space, which then is picked up by capillaries in the adrenal medulla and taken everywhere in the body. All right, so the adrenal cortex, though, is what we want to focus on now, even has different zones. So if we look at the histology of the adrenal cortex, here we can see the adrenal medulla. These are chromaffin cells down over here that are releasing epinephrine. And then here are the layers of the cortex. All right, so we have a capsule around the adrenal gland that's made out of connective tissue. And so it's not epithelium, right? That's just the capsule for the adrenal gland. Then we have the next deeper layer, the zona glomerulosa. What does this kind of remind you of? From anatomy. Almost reminds you of the skin a little bit, right? Some of the different layers of the skin, okay? In particular, the epithelium. All right, so here, the most superficial layer is the zona glomerulosa. The next deepest one is the zona fasciculata. And then the deepest area of the cortex is the reticularis. And these are going to be responsible for secreting different hormones. Okay? Well, we just said, what, that the medulla is controlled by sympathetic innervation, but the adrenal cortex is not controlled by innervation, it's controlled by a hormone, namely ACTH, adrenal corticotropic hormone. Right? And it secretes, when ACTH increases, it causes the adrenal cortex to release glucocorticoids like cortisol, as well as mineralocorticoids like aldosterone. So let's talk about these two first. All right, cortisol is a glucocorticoid. So you might guess that it has something to do with glucose metabolism. Cortisol inhibits glucose utilization and stimulates gluconeogenesis. What does that mean? What's gluconeogenesis? When glycolytic intermediates like maybe pyruvate go the opposite direction through glycolysis, right? And that produces glucose when that happens. Right? So cortisol increases blood glucose levels as a result. And what else does cortisol do? It decreases glucose utilization. So what happens to blood glucose when cortisol is present? Does it go up or go down? It goes up as a result of that. All right, so we call that a glucocorticoid. Aldosterone, on the other hand, works on the kidneys. It causes reabsorption of sodium. Right? Just like ADH causes reabsorption of water from the filtrate or urine. Right? So when there is aldosterone, what happens to blood sodium levels if it stimulates reabsorption? It prevents the loss of sodium in the urine, so you maintain high sodium levels inside your body when aldosterone is there. Right? Is sodium an important chemical in your body? Yeah, what is sodium good for? How about resting membrane potential, action potential, graded potentials, right? So it's a very important ion for communication and regulation in your body. So it's got to be regulated, right? And aldosterone plays a major role in that, okay? The other thing that I want you to see, and I'm going to mention this a couple of times later on in the class, notice what the effect of aldosterone is on sodium and potassium. Is it the same or is it opposite? It is opposite to each other. And so I really want to just have that ingrained in your memory, even though maybe you don't really fully understand aldosterone just yet. But you're probably going to see a question on a board exam or two about the action of aldosterone. All right, and here's a clue for answering that question correctly every time. What's the action of aldosterone on sodium and potassium? Does it cause elimination of both? Does it cause the retention of both? And if you see an answer that says the opposite, what are you going to select? Just the opposite, even if you can't remember which way they're going, right? So just try to remember that. I'll mention that again, right? Aldosterone has the opposite effect on retention in the body from sodium to potassium, okay? And the cortex also releases some supplementary sex steroids, in particular androgens, male sex steroids. In particular, in both males and females, all right? And why is that a really good thing? Where do you find what kind of hormone would you associate with aggressive behavior? Testosterone or estrogen? Testosterone. Probably testosterone, okay? And who exhibits, probably in my estimation, the most aggressive behavior? No. That was close. But women, under what circumstances? Like? When they're protecting their young, right? Okay, so the maternal instinct is driven by testosterone, so women have to have testosterone. And, like if you, for instance, if you're out walking in the forest someplace and you see some little bear cubs, what are you going to do? Go up to the bear cub and pet it? Yeah, no way, okay? So, and of course, sex drive also is related to testosterone, and that comes from the adrenal cortex. All right, so where do these mineralocorticoids and glucocorticoids and sex steroids come from? The adrenal cortex for sure, all right, but specific layers within the adrenal cortex and one precursor molecule. So these are all steroids. Where do all steroids come from? Cholesterol, that's the base molecule. Cholesterol has to be modified. So in the zona glomerulosa, which secretes mineralocorticoids, right, you see cholesterol is converted into pregnenolone and then progesterone. Ooh, that's a female sex steroid right there. And then converted finally into aldosterone. So I do want you to know that cholesterol is the base molecule and aldosterone is produced in the zona glomerulosa. All right, then we have the fasciculata and reticularis for glucocorticoids and sex steroids. And again, the precursor molecule is cholesterol, and cholesterol then is modified into various forms to produce cortisol and corticosterone, which are glucocorticoids, which regulate what kind of metabolism? Glucose, right? Glucose metabolism. And then finally, cholesterol is used to make various kinds of androgens as well, right? Male sex hormone. All right, the adrenal medulla. I think we talked about all this stuff already. Okay, so I don't think I'm going to spend any time on this slide. Okay, thyroid gland. Thyroid gland is under the control of the pituitary gland. What part of the pituitary gland? The anterior pituitary, because the anterior pituitary releases thyroid stimulating hormone, and that causes the growth or the maintenance of the thyroid gland and also the release of thyroxine. Okay, and I think we mentioned that thyroxine has two main hormones, or T3 and T4, depending on how many iodines are on the molecule. All right, and so that sets the basal metabolic rate, and it's necessary for growth and development as well. All right, so the thyroid gland consists of like little tiny sacs, which we call follicles. And the cells that make up the follicle on the outside in the periphery are called follicular cells, and they synthesize T3 and T4, and then that is secreted into the interior of the follicle that's filled with fluid, and it contains some proteins. And that interior fluid-filled portion is what we call the colloid. All right, so here is a follicle, and of course you can see that it's microscopic. So here is the colloid inside the follicle. Here are the cells that are producing thyroid hormone or thyroxine. So you need an element to make an active thyroid hormone, and an element you can't make. Right? An element would be something like, what's an element? You know an element. Give me a couple examples of some elements. Like copper, iron, sodium, calcium, right? Those are all elements. Your body can't make them. Does anybody know where those things, most of those things come from? How are they made in our universe? Has nothing to do with physiology, but it's kind of interesting to note. They're made when a star explodes, when it goes into supernova. So these kind of, it's just kind of interesting that these controlling elements in our body come from some star that exploded way, way back when in the development of the universe. Okay. So here we have iodide. It's an ion. Okay, you have to have this in your diet because you can't make that, right? Because have you ever gone supernova? I hope not, right? All right, so iodide we have to have that in our diet, and it's imported into the, by these follicular cells, and then it's reduced into iodine, into I2. Right, and then it's incorporated with some amino acids like tyrosine to make monoiodotyrosine and diiodotyrosine. And then these are combined, right? If we have a monoiodotyrosine and a di, that makes triiodothreonine right here. And diiodo, if we put two of these diiodos together, we get T4. And then since these are lipophilic kinds of compounds, they don't want to be in solution, so they're packaged with this particular protein so that they can dissolve in the water environment of the colloid, right? And so that protein is what we call thyroglobulin. So they're stored in the thyroid gland, and they're released by exocytosis. And what causes the release of T3 and T4 from the thyroid gland? Does the thyroid gland just kind of make up its own mind, or is it looking for action potentials from a nerve someplace, like the adrenal medulla, or what causes release? It says right here on your slide, thyroid stimulating hormone causes the release of thyroxine, which is what, T3 and T4, from the thyroid gland. Where does TSH come from, thyroid stimulating hormone? Where does that come from? That's from the adrenal, no, hold on. TSH, that comes from the anterior pituitary. I'm just looking at everybody's confusion there. All right, from the anterior pituitary, releases TSH. And then the thyroid gland releases T3 and T4 into the plasma. But, of course, T3 and T4 don't want to dissolve in the plasma, so they're carried by carrier proteins within the plasma, which then carry it to various target tissues. Okay. And since these are lipid molecules, right, what kind of receptors do they bind to? Cytoplasmic receptors, right, which then act as transcription factors in the body for protein synthesis. And that's why they're important for growth and development, as well as regulating basal metabolic rate. All right, so let's look at some ways that homeostasis is maintained. How is homeostasis maintained? What's a good way to think about that? Response loops, right? Okay, so here is some response loops. So we have the hypothalamus releasing TSHRH. That goes to the anterior pituitary, which causes the release of thyroid-stimulating hormone, which then goes to the thyroid gland. All right, and the thyroid gland is going to grow and get bigger. It's going to proliferate, and it's going to try to make T3 and T4, thyroxins. Right? But it can only make T3 and T4 if what is present in your diet? Iodine, that's right. Okay, so then a competent T3 and T4 are made, and T3 and T4 are going to go throughout the whole body, stimulating transcription in various tissues. All right, but it's also going to go back to the anterior pituitary, right, and is going to feed back negatively, so it's going to decrease the level of TSH, right, to maintain the proper levels of T3 and T4 in the blood, according to what the set point is. All right. But now let's just think, what's going to happen to somebody if they don't have iodine in their diet? The thyroid gland is going to be stimulated by TSH, and it's going to grow and get bigger, and it's going to be told to make these compounds right here. But can it if iodine is not present? It can't. So if there are no competent T3 and T4 products in the blood, what's going to happen to this negative feedback loop if there's no T3 and T4? Well, it's going to go away because there is no T3 and T4, right? So this negative feedback is going to disappear. So what is the anterior pituitary going to do? It's going to increase levels of thyroid-stimulating hormones, saying, hey, thyroid gland, there's hardly any T3 or T4 in the blood. You better get busy and make some, right? So levels of thyroid-stimulating hormone will increase, right? So the thyroid gland will get bigger. So what we're talking about is this little side reaction right here. All right, so if iodine is inadequate in the diet, it's going to produce low levels of T3 and T4. The negative feedback disappears. The anterior pituitary is going to make excess thyroid stimulating hormone, which will go to the thyroid gland and cause it to proliferate and get really big because it's not making T3 and T4. Right? It's going to try to maintain the set point. And that condition, when the thyroid gland gets really big, when it can't produce a competent thyroid product, we call that goiter. And you will notice that in some people that their thyroid gland is huge. It could be almost as big as their hand, right? And it's really rare in the United States to see this circumstance because where do we have iodine? Yeah, pretty much all salt, unless you buy it in a health food store, right, contains iodine. So that's, I love irony, right? So again, that's, sorry about the play, sort of weird play on words right there. Okay. Okay, so you have plenty of iodine in your diet. But you might notice somebody in other countries, you know, if they just fly into the United States and for whatever reason they didn't have medical care from where they are, you can still see some people with goiters. And how would you treat a goiter? How would you treat somebody with goiter? Just go to the grocery store and buy some salt, right, and have them salt their food and then have iodine in their diet. And under most circumstances, the goiter will resolve itself just with the proper levels of iodine in the diet. Okay. All right, parathyroid hormone comes from the parathyroid glands, which is associated with the thyroid gland, and it helps regulate calcium, blood calcium levels in your body. And what do you know about that? Is that important? For what reason? Why is having the proper levels of calcium in blood important? Why should it be under homeostatic control? What's calcium good for? Makes bones strong, right? You got to have strong bones, otherwise they'll break, right? And you'll lose blood because bones are highly vascular. You could bleed to death. What else is calcium good for? Muscle contraction, I don't think we've talked about that yet, but we're going to talk about that. But for synaptic transmission, right? Synaptic transmission. Calcium is a second messenger, also involved with various hormonal mechanisms, right? So extracellular calcium levels has to be maintained. So let's look at this nice response loop. So here's the stimulus. Decreasing blood calcium levels stimulate the parathyroid glands to release parathyroid hormone. And that's a hormone. It gets picked up by the blood and goes where? Everywhere in the body. So it goes to the kidneys and it goes to bones. Right? Parathyroid hormone is going to stimulate the dissolution of hydroxyapatite in bone. So it's going to break bones down when that happens, and that will increase blood calcium levels. Now, you might not like that, but what's your choice if your blood calcium levels are decreasing? You have only one other choice to break, instead of breaking bones down. Parathyroid hormone goes to the kidneys and it causes reabsorption of calcium. All right, we just talked about reabsorption a couple times. What does that mean? That means that the kidneys are trying to throw calcium away into urine, but reabsorption does what? Takes stuff from the urine and puts it back into the blood. So that's what we mean by reabsorption. We're going to talk about that when we get to the kidney system pretty soon. All right, and so if it's taking calcium out of fluid that will become urine and puts it back in the blood, what does that do to blood calcium levels? That increases blood calcium, and when calcium comes out of bone, it goes into the blood. That increases blood calcium, okay? And how does this relate to the initial stimulus right here? It's the opposite effect, right? So that's a nice negative feedback loop, which maintains blood calcium and extracellular calcium at homeostatic levels to support your life. Okay. Next hormone. The pancreas, or the next endocrine gland, is the pancreas. Pancreas is kind of interesting because you see some ducts. Right? Here's the main pancreatic duct right here. So what kind of gland has a duct? Exocrine gland. But what are we talking about in this chapter? Endocrine. So the pancreas is part exocrine gland and part endocrine gland. And the exocrine part has to do with digestive enzymes that the pancreas produces. And where do those digestive enzymes work? They work in the intestines right here. And so they take this duct system to get to the intestines, which is a really good thing because you don't want digestive enzymes running around inside the pancreas because what would happen? It's going to produce pancreatitis, which means that the pancreas will be digested away, and you can imagine what that would be like. That's what? Horrific. And unfortunately, that does happen. Pancreatitis is a really tough process to handle clinically. All right, but the endocrine part of the pancreas doesn't have ducts, right? There are what we call little islands of cells right here, and that was discovered by this Langerhans fellow, and so they're named after him. These are the islets of Langerhans. And you can see basically two kinds of cells in here, the type 1 and type 2 cells. But they're called, what, alpha and beta cells. They're responsible for secreting some hormones, and the hormones don't end up in the pancreatic duct. They are picked up by, what are these things right here? The red and blue things. These are capillaries, right? So the alpha and beta cells produce a product picked up by these capillaries, so they are hormones. All right, the alpha cells secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose, and glucagon stimulates glycogenolysis. Ooh, what's glycogenolysis? We looked in detail. It uses a phosphatase to break glycogen down into glucose 1 and glucose 6 phosphate, right? And then there's a phosphatase that then can cause the liver to release glucose into the blood. So when glucagon is released, what happens to blood glucose? It goes up. Okay, so glucagon is released by the stimulus of low blood glucose, but if it causes blood glucose to increase, what's the relationship? What kind of feedback loop is working here? A nice negative feedback loop, right? Okay, and glucagon also causes lipolysis. Oh, what is lipolysis? Lipolysis, when you take triglycerides and break them down into fatty acids, and then fatty acids can be given to beta oxidation to make a lot of ATP. Okay, and then the glycerol can also be used to make glucose. All right, and since so that will increase blood glucose when triglycerides are broken down because that makes glycerol. How many glycerols do you need to make a glucose? How many carbons are in glycerol? Triglyceride, that's a nice hint, right? So it has three carbons, so how many of those do you need to make a glucose? You just need two, right? Two glycerols to make a glucose. All right, so glucagon increases blood glucose, right? And when might your body be secreting? Under what conditions is your body going to secrete glucagon? Or the alpha cells of the pancreas secrete glucagon? When you're fasting, when you're in a fasted state to maintain blood glucose. All right, and you probably realize that regulating blood glucose is very important. So what kind of control mechanism would you expect to see? Antagonistic mechanism. So if you have a hormone that increases blood glucose, you would expect to have a hormone that does the opposite, decreases, right? And you're right, and this is the one that you're really familiar with, that would be insulin, right? And insulin is secreted by the islets of Langerhans, but not the alpha cells, the beta cells in particular. So the beta cells can monitor blood glucose, and when blood glucose starts to go up, insulin is secreted, and what does that do? That's going to lower blood glucose by a couple of different mechanisms, right? By promoting the entry of glucose into cells. So when glucose goes from blood to cells, the concentration in blood decreases, right? That's the job of insulin. What kind of transporter is necessary for most cells to take glucose up? Like the GLUT4 transporter? Right? What kind of receptor is responsible for putting GLUT4 transporters into the plasma membrane? What was that receptor? It was a special kind of receptor. Was a tyrosine kinase receptor? We talked about that last time. Oh, you got to go back and review that. Okay. Insulin also promotes the conversion of glucose into glycogen. Ooh, what do we call that process? Glucose to glycogen is glycogenesis. It stimulates glycogenesis, right? It also stimulates the production of fat. We call that lipogenesis. That's lipogenesis, right? And all of these processes are using up glucose, so that decreases blood glucose, bringing it back to its homeostatic level. All right, so here, we got just enough time to talk about this feedback loop right here. So as blood glucose increases, like under what kind of conditions? What kind of outside conditions are going to increase your blood glucose? When you're in a fed state, right? So when you've eaten something, like drink a couple Cokes or something, all right, blood glucose goes up. The beta cells notice that. So here is the receptor in the pancreatic islets, and then they're going to release insulin as a result, and that's going to increase cellular uptake of glucose. So blood glucose goes down. How does that correlate with the initial stimulus? Opposite effect, so that's a nice negative feedback loop. All right, but it also has an effect. Insulin also stimulates, what's this process here? Glucose to glycogen. This is glycogenesis in liver and muscle that decreases blood glucose. It also stimulates glucose to triglycerides. We call that lipogenesis, so you can label that arrow right there, and that helps adipose tissue grow. Okay, guess what? We're done. All right, so I forgot. When's the next test? April 13th. That's a Tuesday. Hopefully I'm here that day.